Good morning, everyone. Why don't we go ahead and get started? Wanted to welcome you to this presentation on China energy issues and the energy outlook. First, I'm David Pumphrey. I'm Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. And it's certainly a great pleasure to have Jonathan Sinton here with us. He was a principal author of, I know, the China portions of the latest World Energy Outlook that the IEA has released. The IEA has been really deepening its ties with China, and I think that that's one of the issues that we'd like to delve into as well, is where Jonathan sees the IEA's relationship with China going forward. But briefly, there should be information there on Jonathan's background, but he spent a number of years with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in their China energy program, the China Energy Group, which I think was really one of the first major programs to launch analytical studies. Wasn't that right, Jonathan? I mean, really is a focal point. And I think that Jonathan's background there really prepared him well to then move to the IEA in an office that has just been renamed into the Global Energy Dialogue, which used to be some other very nondescript, I think, office A and B, so that no one had a name. So they're now actually putting forward what their goal is. So I think before starting and having Jonathan start, we'd like to just go around the room quickly so he has a feeling for the crowd that he's facing and can start anticipating the questions that he may get. So if we want to start.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here today. As has been mentioned, I was an analyst at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab for a long time. Now I am an international bureaucrat, and I'm here to show you that I do indeed have a face. And most of us over there in Paris do have faces, I can tell you from personal experience. And so I'm happy to bring it here and show it to you and share what we know, because after all, you're helping to pay my salary, and along with the citizens of the other 26 member countries. Recently expanded to 27, the Slovak Republic is now a member. So I think it's really important to let you know what we're doing with China. As the desk officer for China and Jeff Logan's successor, I spend a lot of time in China. About every other month, I take a trip of at least a week there, and I'm sure many of you have been there as well and know what's going on. So, or may even have come from there. So, I don't need to stress the importance of China and the need for the U.S. and China to work together. In one of our IEA meetings recently, Peter Nolan, a professor at Cambridge University, came and talked to us. In his view, and I think it's shared by many, the U.S.-China relationship is going to be one of the defining features of this century, and it's something that bears a great deal of attention in all its aspects, and energy and environment is not least among those and bears upon virtually all of the issues that we care about, whatever field we may come from. The IEA has been working with China for 20 years, more or less. For the past 11 years, it's had a memorandum of understanding with the National Development and Reform Commission and its predecessor organizations on working in the field of energy. In 2001, it also signed an MOU with the Ministry of Science and Technology to beef up cooperation on energy technology R&D. Just last year, the IEA Governing Board prepared an outreach strategy for working with non-member countries, and it prioritized three countries, China, India, and Russia, roughly in that order, although India and Russia do tend to trade places depending on which country you come from. But China is clearly the object of most of the attention, which has made my life quite busy. There are two things. There are many reasons for this focus. Two of the main ones are concern about security of energy, stability of global oil markets, and climate change as well. China, of course, being now probably the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. All three of these countries need to be engaged. It is now clearly not possible to deal effectively with energy security issues, with climate change issues, without these three countries being engaged. And it is important to engage them bilaterally and multilaterally through organizations like the IEA, World Bank, the International Energy Forum, and elsewhere. I want to be clear about the IEA's position. China is a partner, not an opponent. The IEA is all about engagement and bringing China closer to the work of the IEA. The reasons for China's prominence now are very complex, lie within its borders and beyond its borders as well. And they are participating in an energy and technological system that's been pioneered by the U.S. And other developed countries. And they're doing so on a fairly narrowly based, or narrow resource base of coal and not much else, at least in per capita terms. For most of us who were not alive during the early Qing Dynasty, China's prominence is a new thing, and it takes a while for us to get used to, and it's taking a while, clearly, for them to get used to. A lot of their reactions seem to come from a position of perceived self weakness, and that is something that's going to have to change. We need to keep clearly our self-interest in mind when dealing with China. It does not always pay to be entirely confrontational, particularly on energy and environmental issues. I think if all parties keep in mind, clearly in mind, their self-interests, their respective self-interests, we'll find ways forward. So I'd like to talk a little bit about two challenges I mentioned, energy security and climate change, and then talk a little bit more about the IEA's work with China. Most of the slides that I'm going to show you come from the World Energy Outlook. Those of you who have seen Mr. Tanaka and Dr. Birol's presentations will have seen some of them, but I won't dwell too much on them. First of all, just to remind you of where China stands, these are results from the World Energy Outlook's reference scenario. The reference scenario is essentially a frozen policy scenario. If those policies that are in place now were not to change, what might happen? It's clearly not a most likely scenario. Things obviously will change. The purpose of the scenario is to point out what would happen if we were not to deal with the issues that clearly are very pressing. And it is something of a nightmare scenario. Primary energy demand will be pushed up very, in large part, by China. From 2005 to 2030, about half of world primary energy demand, the incremental demand, would come from China. And that would be mainly because of China's lion's share, about three-quarters of the increase in coal demand. And most of that would be going for power generation. Right now, China uses about half of it, a little over half of its coal for power generation, heat delivery. That proportion is set to rise. In terms of oil demand and oil imports, it stands at about a quarter, roughly in line with China's proportion of world population, a little bit higher. And CO2 emissions, because of the high proportion of coal in China's energy economy, be a bit over half. If you look at the alternative policy scenario, the high growth scenario, the percentages are more or less the same.
Excuse me, is that a forecast or those are actual numbers?
Well, 2015, having
the previous
slide.
Chart. It's the forecast.
Oh,
forecast growth.
Their forecast, yes. I'm sorry, I don't know how to operate this clearly. So let's see, we want to go up. Okay, these are four. I'm sorry. This is past growth. Pardon me. I misspoke. Yes, this is past, and in future there you see fairly similar. Pardon me. Jet lag is obviously catching up with me.
Before you get off that chart, I hate to dwell on it, but
please, let's dwell.
The last blue you indicate for represents the rest of the world.
I don't know how to.
Put your mouse.
Okay. I'm afraid to hit. Yes.
I would be very interested to know what the U.S. share of that light blue is, particularly in regards to CO2 emissions.
Don't know off the top of my head, but. The U.S. It would not be as large as in the past, not as large as say if you looked at cumulative emissions, because as China's energy growth has been rising very quickly in the past few years, in the first half of this decade, the U.S. has actually sort of slowed down quite a bit. So, looking forward. Not sure. So, okay. Now, getting into the projections. This is just concerned with China, just to highlight the prominence of coal. Clearly, from today's level, you see oil consumption about doubling, and coal doing approximately the same in the reference scenario. Although natural gas, renewables, nuclear are all growing at a fairly rapid rate, faster than coal. By the end of the projection period, they're still relatively small. Even if you look at the alternative policy scenarios, there's no quick path away from coal for China. We're looking at a coal-dominated economy for decades to come under reference assumptions and under a variety of other assumptions as well. And China's energy end use is dominated by industry today, and that will continue. Again, like the energy system, the economy, the structural change in the economy is a decades, many decades long process. And so industrial and particularly heavy industry will continue to be responsible for half or a bit more than half of energy use in the industrial sector. So. Turning to oil, this is from the IEA's medium-term oil market report. If you look at these pale blue bars, these are estimated increase in demand for oil from the various regions. Asia is clearly dominated by China, and it's about twice as large as the incremental demand in the Middle East and in North America as well. So clearly this is a key region. Just an aside, I think there is growing attention to the issue of the consumption of oil in the producing countries, which means clearly as for China, energy efficiency should be a key topic of exchanges with them. The more efficient they are, the less oil they'll use, the more they'll have to export to the rest of the consuming nations. In the longer term, China is, of course, going to be a huge new. This is incremental growth, about 17 million barrels per day, additional demand under reference scenario projections. The yellow bands are India. Under the high growth scenario, where both countries have GDP growth rates 1.5 percentage points higher than in the reference scenario, there is an additional 6 or 7 million barrels per day added as well. Under the reference scenario, the GDP growth is 6% over the projection period, starting at about 7.7% to 2015, declining thereafter. Transport and a good deal from the petrochemical sector as well, but in particular transport. When you look at light-duty vehicle sales, China's already, you may have seen this, China's already overtaken Japan under reference assumptions. It would overtake the U.S. around 2015. This from a country that has car ownership levels similar to what we're seeing in the U.S. around World War I. So, fortunately, China doesn't have a great deal of space to put a lot more cars, so it's clearly impossible for China to reach U.S. current U.S. levels or even European or Japanese levels. But soaring car ownership, both private and in the corporate sector, is pushing up oil demand. These green bars are domestic projections of domestic production, and the top of the bars represent total consumption. China's oil production is going up only very slowly. Based on current estimates of resources, it's likely to peak fairly soon, even with the new discoveries and enhanced output from older fields, and decline slowly over the projection period, meaning that virtually all incremental demand will be coming from imports, raising the question for them of security of imports just as much as for the rest of us. And I think you've probably all thought about this quite a bit. From the if you look at China and India's consumption compared to OECD, by 2030, their combined consumption will be more than half of the combined consumption of OECD countries, meaning that their emergency stockpiles should be more than half the level of combined OECD countries. China has only just started to fill its first phase of its tanks, and says it only has 2 or 3 million barrels, a fairly small amount. When we had a Chinese delegation visiting last week from Beijing, they did not say anything about the current levels that they have. They steadfastly refused to talk about this, but hints that they dropped seem to indicate that they have stopped buying and filling because of the current high price. Or maybe that's simply what they'd just like us to think. Nevertheless, it's still unclear if China is filling. It's filling at a very, very slow rate or not at all. It's not on track for quickly attaining a 90-day net import level of stocks. When asked about what their long-range plans are, they always punt on the question, say, we're considering plans, we're putting them together, we'll let you know when we know. But they do point out that it's taken a very long time for IEA member countries to build up their own stocks at a time when oil prices were much lower. It takes decades. We should not be expecting the Chinese to build up very quickly or very soon. I'll talk a little bit more about this issue later. Turning to CO2 emissions, under the reference scenario, the gray bars are cumulative emissions, 1900 to 2005, and the red bars are additional emissions, 2005 to 2030. So, in a cumulative sense, China plus India look fairly small. In 2005, it stood at about 10% of cumulative emissions, whereas OECD combined is about 60%. Even with strong growth in their emissions, by 2030, China and India combined would be about 20%, while the OECD will have slipped to about 50%. So even with this looking forward to many years of high emissions growth from these countries, their cumulative emissions are going to be rising much more slowly, and you can be sure that this is a point that they're going to be raising with us. So in terms of equity. But if we're just looking at today's emissions, just comparing the two red bars, China and the U.S., China will be responsible for maybe about 1.5 times as much of additional emissions as the U.S. under these reference scenario assumptions. Again, under other scenarios, all countries, under like the alternative policy scenario, all countries would be doing a great deal to rein in emissions, and so the proportions would remain similar. A lot of headlines deal with China's position as the number one emitter. In all the scenarios that we've done, China has become, remains the largest emitter by far, keeps extending its lead. This doesn't change the basic fact that all of us, China and the rest of us, all need to deal with emissions. So it's good to get very important numbers, but good to get beyond the headlines, at least in terms of engaging China. This CO2 emissions chart essentially mirrors the energy chart, showing that coal, which has a much higher CO2 emissions factor than other fuels, is providing about on the order of 80% of China's emissions by throughout the period. I mentioned a lot of this coal consumption is coming from power generation. This shows power generation additions in the first half of this decade, with China alone and just coal-fired generation dwarfing all additions in all OECD countries. This year's additions are likely to be somewhat smaller than last year. Last year was over 110 gigawatts. This year, somewhere between 80 and 90 gigawatts, depending on what projections you believe. Still the size of a sizable OECD country. When you look at China's projections for nuclear power generation, wind power generation, these alternatives, they're talking about 40 gigawatts by 2020 of nuclear, 30 gigawatts of wind by 2020. That's a fraction, fairly sizable fraction, but still a fraction of 1 year's installed capacity of new coal-fired capacity. India is a dwarf by comparison, but a fairly sizable one. Now, the larger the impression that many of us have of Chinese technology in power generation and other energy-intensive sectors is that it's old, it's inefficient, it's highly polluting, and that's all correct for a lot of the installed capacity. But what's going in now, the new build, is much, much better than it was in the past. A lot more of it has FGD, or at least space for installing scrubbers, and most of the new build is in 600 megawatt supercritical units, and they're looking at ultra supercritical as well. So the Chinese new build is still pretty far from state of the art, but it's over 35%, 37%, 38% efficiency, and that's only going to increase. China has fairly strong policies to mandate and to encourage better coal-fired power generation, and as that portion of the generation mix expands, the older, smaller units are going to be smaller. They're still going to be fairly large by world terms. Now, much has been made in China of their campaign to close down smaller units. That it was 50 megawatt and under before, now 100 megawatt and under. And you can see dramatic pictures on the evening news in China sometimes, or in the papers, of small units being dynamited. And this is certainly one way to prevent a power plant from reopening after you close it and walk away. There are only so many plants that you can dynamite. And you see chemical factories and paper mills and cement plants suffering the same fate. A lot of this is a demonstration by local officials that they are indeed complying with a campaign that is being pushed very strongly from the highest levels of the Chinese government. Wen Jiabao apparently takes the efficiency campaign, the environmental cleanup campaign, very, very personally, and is very forceful on the issue, and this is being transmitted down through the bureaucracy, where there's a lot of hiring going on in the units that are responsible for energy management. And you look at the National Bureau of Statistics, which the IEA collaborates with, they've been doing a lot of hiring as well. They used to have only three or four people in Beijing dealing with the entire country's energy statistics. Now they have double that number, still too few, but the numbers in the provinces that are feeding numbers up the chain have expanded greatly. And they need training. They've come to us, to the IEA, for training. They sent a delegation at their own expense about 3 weeks ago, half a dozen, to work out a three-year program of cooperation, which includes secondments of Chinese energy statisticians to the IEA. It includes organizing IEA organizing staff of statistical staff from member countries who know how to carry out energy surveys to go to China and talk with them about how to do their own energy surveys. When you look at key areas like transport, China's energy transport consumption statistics are terrible. There's nothing there. There are estimates based on a few widely scattered points, estimates of vehicle populations, trying to square it with sales of motor fuels. It's really quite bad. So they have to, they're in the middle of a transformation from a statistical system that's based on a planning system with complete reporting to one that's survey-based. They're between two stools, and we're trying to help pull them on to another stool so that they have better numbers, so that they can track their progress. Okay. I'm not going to spend much time on this. This is just to give you a flavor of the breadth of energy efficiency policies that have been rolled out over the past few years. The revision of the energy conservation law came out this year. There was one that came out in the 1990s, never really implemented, and a new update has come out in an attempt to try to set something in place that's a bit better. The top 10 key energy efficiency projects. These are receiving some funding. Finally, apparently there was an allocation from the Ministry of Finance of about $3 billion this year for a variety of things, not just these key projects and boiler retrofits and so forth, but also environmental projects. So they're putting a lot of money out there. The Top 1,000 Enterprises program deals with the largest energy consumers in six industrial sectors, three energy sectors. Collectively, the Chinese say that they're responsible for about a third or about 30% of energy consumption. It doesn't include biomass, of course. And all of these plants have been given targets that they were required to sign on to energy intensity reduction targets without knowing exactly how they were going to achieve them. Program was rolled out a little bit too early, and so now there are projects being put in place to put methods out there for benchmarking to monitor performance of these. Some of these enterprises are very good. They know what the status of their equipment is. They know what they need to move forward and have investment plans in place, and others need quite a bit of technical help. Energy intensity reporting system. This, you may be aware of the reports on progress in energy intensity that China is starting to put out. This 20% target, which is in the 11th five-year plan, is to reduce energy intensity by 20% in 2010 compared to 2005. And that target has been farmed out to the province levels, which have all been required to sign on to agreements, and a little bit more than 20%, a little bit less than 20%, and they've passed that on down to the prefectural, the municipal, county level. And in turn, these local administrations have tried to figure out, they've taken them very seriously and have brought to the major energy consumers in to try to work out how it can be done. And of course, there's all sorts of fiddling going on. It's not all technical efficiency. There are changes in energy or in the output structure of various increasing output of high value-added products in order to get the numbers right. But people are taking it very seriously. Apparently, the performance with respect to these targets is going to be folded into the performance review of local officials, the performance review that is on which promotions are based. So essentially, the Chinese government is taking the step of making efficiency personal for local officials. The potential for savings in China is great. If you just look at two classes of products, air conditioners and efficiency, China does have efficient products on the market. not a dominant share. It does have energy efficiency standards, which are broadly and pretty well applied, but they're too loose. If they're progressively tightened, and under assumptions in the alternative policy scenario, by 2030, just in these two classes alone, China could save the equivalent of two Three Gorges dams, which would help them to avoid some problems with their neighbors to the south. Of course, China maintains that CO2 is our problem, not their problem, but they do have serious issues with sulfur dioxide, with particulates, and a growing problem with NOx. Improved energy efficiency could help a great deal in meeting their targets for reducing SO2 emissions. About a third of China's territory suffers from acid precipitation. It's not a pretty picture. And this is one of the chief air pollution problems that's facing China right now. If you go to CO2, then there's a problem with coloration here. This purple band is energy efficiency. If China were to vigorously pursue a variety of policies, it could essentially flatten out its emissions profile by the end of the projection period, by 2030. And about two-fifths of that would come from efficiency on the demand side, and fairly large percentage would come from, fuel efficiency and electricity efficiency together would be about two-thirds of that. Thank you very much. So this alternative policy scenario just takes into account things that China is considering, things that it could do better. The purpose of the WEO is not doom and gloom, but to show how one can avoid the doom and gloom type of scenario. Of course, China's performance in this regard, because it is such a large proportion of global emissions, would help the global emissions profile tremendously, bringing down CO2 emissions between the reference and alternative scenario by about the size of China's current emissions. So how to engage China on these issues? Broadly speaking, the IEA works with China in five areas: on energy security, on statistics, on energy analysis like the World Energy Outlook, on policy, transferring of best practices, and energy technology R&D as well. In terms of the first two, the IEA occupies a rather unique role with respect to China, since the IEA is the focal point for organizing and response to global supply emergencies. That this is a very important reference point for China. When China talks about its strategic reserves, it's constantly referring to the IEA's 90-day requirement for member countries, and that is really a standard that it's taken to heart, the goal that it is looking towards internally. They've started to, they certainly look to IEA member countries for the variety of practices that are taken in building stocks and managing them. The first phase of their strategic storage is all above ground storage. For the second phase, they would like at least some of that to be underground storage. And they've already been sending delegations around trying to see what the U.S. and other member countries are doing with that regard. And moving forward, we're likely to see a good deal of cooperation in that regard. In terms of use of stocks, emergency response, China does not seem ready to declare that it will coordinate its response with the IEA. It would be nice if we could reach a point where we have an MOU that at least says something like, we, China, agree not to start to accelerate filling of our reserves when you release oil onto the market to deal with a supply emergency. It is a good place to start, but they're not quite ready. Chen Deming, the former vice chairman of NDRC with the energy portfolio, now Minister of Commerce, said an interesting thing to Mr. Mandil, who former executive director has also moved on, earlier this year in discussions on this topic and the inevitable call from the IEA to release information on stocks and the inevitable refusal on the part of China. Mr. Chen said that when we have maybe our first set of tanks filled, say around 2010 or so, then we might be ready to start talking about coordination. So it's the message there was that China feels like it has to get a little bit farther along in getting its house in order, has to fill its tanks a certain amount, it has to get its people in place before it's ready to talk about any sort of coordination. Now, to a certain extent, if there were political will, clearly they could say, as we move forward, we are using you as a reference point, and we are working towards coordination. But the political will doesn't seem to be there. We'll see what the next energy minister equivalent in China has to say about that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just last night. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. I love being overtaken by events. This is good. In terms of energy statistics, I've mentioned cooperation in that area. Because the IEA is a reference point for member countries, it also is for China as well. Clearly, the IEA does not have the capacity to actually go out and do surveys, a lot of the work that China needs to do, but it is an important coordinator of that. And we've gotten some voluntary contributions to work extensively with China.
Can I bring
yes?
a point there?
Certainly.
Think that, improved mm-hmm. energy statistics mm-hmm. can make a difference in China mm-hmm. without political reform? In other words, do you think, for example, you gave the case that mm-hmm. provincial officials will now be judged on the savings that they say mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But who's going to verify that those statistics that they're reporting are accurate?
Mm-hmm.
And without political reform, will that be able to make a difference?
Oh, that's a good point. Without political reform, there is no guarantee, obviously, absent imposition from the top. Of putting the fear of God into everybody that indeed this is going to be watched carefully, and any fooling around with the numbers is going to be severely punished. So it does it is a bit futile in that sense, in that it depends upon personalities and the spotlight being shown. That there's an important opportunity here, however, It's been very common in the past in China's energy efficiency campaigns for a spotlight to be focused on energy performance, and then the spotlight moves on. Institutions have not been built, people have not been hired, and then things fall back to the way they were before. There seems to be a slight difference this time. It's too early to tell, but there are people being hired, people being trained up, essentially. An institutional voice is being created. The National Bureau of Statistics has, when you talk with people on the working level, they're very sensitive to criticism about their numbers being politically motivated or tampered with, and they want to be seen as a world-class agency. There's a strong sense of professionalism among them, and that's one reason why they want to be engaged with the IEA and statistical agencies around the world. And that sense of mission of that agency is a strong counterweight to political interference. Political interference is always a possibility. there's a strong effort to bring the provincial and municipal energy statisticians into the fold. They are sent to Beijing every year for training. They're inculcated with the culture, so there's a more of a top-down approach to it than, say, what you've seen in the Environmental Protection Bureau, the local Environmental Protection Bureaus, where funding comes from the local party bosses and local government. There's a lot more sort of self-interest there. So tampering always remains a possibility, unfortunately, but there are some counterweights to it.
Better statistics can also drive political reform, might keep people much more accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Numbers don't add up when you look, compare them to the next province, then you know somebody's cheating.
Mm-hmm. That's right. In terms of analysis, policy, technology cooperation, the IEA does not occupy as such a privileged position with respect to China. It's just one more multilateral among the universe of multilateral and bilateral cooperation in these topic areas. But the IEA does remain a crossroads for a lot of these things. I might point out the country review process. The IEA has a country studies division every 3 or 4 years. Each of the member countries undergoes an in-depth review. Last week at the governing board, it was the turn of Finland and the United States. It was very instructive for the Chinese delegation to see the member countries undergoing a process of constructive criticism. They're so sensitive about criticism themselves, they seem to be rather deeply impressed by that process. It's something that the IEA does with non-member countries. Currently, an in-depth review of Indonesia is being prepared. Minister Purnomo signed an agreement with the IEA. A two-week mission was sent earlier this year. Interviews with 40 sets of stakeholders were held, and early next year that review will be put out. China's also following that closely. China itself is not ready to undergo such a review, but that is one of the points by which we will be gauging the IEA's progress in bringing China into the fold.
Are those publicly available documents when
they're done? If you have the money, yes.
Right.
Yes. After, I think, two or three years, all the publications are free, but when they first come out, they cost money. yes. And technology cooperation. The IEA is an organizer of technology cooperation, but doesn't actually perform it itself. It has 40-some implementing agreements, which are essentially ways of getting like-minded groups together to cooperate on energy technology issues. China's a party to four of these now, including the IEA Clean Coal Center, which is located in London. Last month, a two-day workshop was held in Beijing with the Ministry of Science and Technology, sort of a matchmaking party to get more Chinese organizations involved in implementing agreements. One does not have to come from a member country in order to belong to an implementing agreement. So there's... Before I finish, I might finish with a few remarks about last week's meeting. I'm sorry, you have a question first?
Question to follow up on Holly's question, going back to number four. Mm-hmm. Do you have like an online store or a bookstore somewhere where you can get these publications?
Absolutely.
Online?
Yes, certainly can. I guess it's not there. www.iea.org. And there's a bookshop. If you can't find what you're looking for, drop me a line. I'll see if I can find
that's
it for you.
It
is. It is.
I think the OECD office here in Washington also handles the publication, so you can
go to them. There's a tremendous amount of paper that comes out of the IEA every year, every month, and there's a large publications office. Every time we make, every time we go on visits to China, I go heavily laden and return very light, unlike some others who take the opposite approach. I just want to finish with a talk about last week's so-called committee week. Last week, the IEA's governing board and four of its five committees held their meetings in the span of a single week. It's never happened before. It was done to make it more cost-effective for China and for India, not Russia, to send delegations. Russia is sort of a special case. Both countries did send delegations. As per usual, we were not sure right up until the last minute whether the delegations would actually come, whether they had their visas. But in the end, NDRC sent five people, three from the Energy Bureau, one from their Foreign Affairs Office, and one from their Energy Conservation Division. The mission was led by the head of the National Oil Reserve Office, Mr. Pei. Not really an appropriate level for the governing board meeting, you know, one grade below, but certainly appropriate for the committee meetings, and certainly in terms of substance. With the makeup of, in addition, they sent representatives from three of the oil companies. The head and deputy head of the planning divisions in CNPC and in Sinopec, and also someone from the London office of Sinochem as well. In addition, we had four observers from the China Coal Information Institute, China Coal Research Institute, which provide advice to China on all matters related to coal supply, coal utilization, particularly in power. Very strong showing to have a dozen people there. And three out of, on the order of 50 people in the in the Energy Bureau, if the Department of Energy were to send a similar fraction of their employees to an IEA meeting, it would be a logistical nightmare, I'm sure. It's not really a fair comparison, but it at least demonstrates the seriousness with which China is taking this. In particular, it was gratifying to see that level of participation after the reaction to the World Energy Outlook, which was not entirely welcoming. In the press release in Beijing, Mr. Tanaka, Dr. Birol, and I shared the stage with Mr. Wang Siqiang, who is head of one of the divisions in the Office of the National Energy Leading Group. Office of the National Energy Leading Group is a rather strange animal that serves the National Energy Leading Group. It counts itself as the equal, the bureaucratic equal of the Energy Bureau, whereas NDRC maintains that it is part of NDRC and subordinate to it. So, nevertheless, it does have its own significant duties. It has been shepherding along the energy law procedure. You may know that the draft of the energy law was released for public comment last week, and it's possible that it will be passed in next March's National People's Congress session. Mr. Wang shared the stage with us, and instead of the usual remarks being fully supportive of a joint effort, declared that there were some points of disagreement with both the assumptions and the outcomes. These we received the similar criticisms expressed a little bit more strongly in private meetings as well, and there were many within China who felt that that the World Energy Outlook was quite detrimental to China, that it would provide ammunition to those who want to blame China for currently high world oil prices and for possible future price rises. So, a little bit of a sticky situation for us. Part of it arises from a fundamental difference of opinion over what constitutes a reference scenario. For China, a reference scenario is what the plans are, You know, that's the starting point. And for the IA, it's not. So, but there was strong participation in the committee week meetings. Last week, the Chinese were asked to prepare presentations. They did give them. Many questions were asked of them. They referred back to their presentations with regard to oil. But on the subject of energy efficiency, which they're very proud, the answers were quite forthcoming. There was quite a bit of discussion. A lot of discussion on the margins as well. The state oil, the national oil companies are interested in seconding some of their people to the IEA as member country energy companies do second people to the IEA, and this would provide an opportunity for learning a bit more about how their planning and internal operations go a little bit. So that all very good stuff. I've been gabbing at you for much longer than I had intended. So happy to take questions.
Thanks, Jonathan. We sort of have a tradition here of trying to have our questions actually be questions. So if you have a statement or comment to make, at least end it with a question mark somehow, even if it is to say, don't you agree with me? But why don't we throw the floor open? Thank you very much, Jonathan. It was a great presentation. I think that... And question, are we going to be able to put this up on the website here?
Certainly.
The presentation. Yeah. So for everybody, we'll have it up on the website. Okay, so I saw first.
Yeah. You talk a little bit about how China's subsidy programs affect its energy use in terms of inefficiency and whether or not the government is going to try to address that.
Most subsidies have already been squeezed out of the system, and the prices, the energy prices that most consumers face for most products are already consistent with what's seen in other countries. What's paid, what drivers pay for gas and diesel in China is very similar to what you see here. That is low by world standards. There have been an intention to gradually raise prices of oil products, which is where you see most of the subsidies, indirect subsidies, really, you know, occasional large transfer payments to Sinopec, essentially. The latest price rise, about 8%, was did not change the basic problem that refiners face, that they're in the red, that they're losing money on every barrel that refine. So if oil prices or retail oil prices were allowed to rise to reasonable levels that reflected the actual cost of oil, you might see a rise in consumption. Refiners are restricting their crude runs because of the losses that they're inflicting upon themselves. But I don't think we're likely to see rapid rises in oil prices. In terms of electricity, heat pricing is another area where there are continued subsidies. And so heat reform is an important barrier to improving efficiency and promoting CHP, for instance. I don't have any special insight into that, I'm afraid. But the assumption is very much the latter case that you outlined. Even if Africa were to start growing relatively quickly, it would still be by 25 years from now pretty tiny compared to China.
For those of us who've come to previous presentations here,
that's a good point, and I'm glad you brought that out. When you talk to say Barlow Yonker, which is a coal sector analyst, that they're based in Australia but have a very strong Beijing office. They talk about this as well, and they're very familiar with exactly what is in which fields in Shaanxi and Inner Mongolia, why it doesn't make sense to bring Xinjiang coal to the East Coast. And under these reference scenario type of projections, yes, China's going to probably fairly quickly run up against resource constraints, in addition to transport constraints, which are going to cause China to look abroad for coal, at least in the south. And it's a mixed picture. The future seems to hold greater coal trade for China, greater exports of high-quality coking coal from North China, even as there will be greater imports of utility coal into southern China. The Australians seem to be quite happy to export coal to China. Their concern is more with the volatility of China's demand. Now, they can, over the long term, if they're able to plan for a gradually larger presence of China on the world markets as an importer, that would not be disruptive. What would be disruptive is if China's a net importer 1 year, net exporter the next year. Bit of a boom and bust cycle. And China is not able to provide any of its own forecasts that would that are useful for Australia and others who might be providing coal. But clearly, China wants to import. It's investing in Colombia, for instance. When you look at the coal trade issue in the reference scenario, China becomes a larger and larger net coal importer over the period. Under the alternative policy scenario, it's essentially net zero, larger trade overall, but net zero.
I mean, but how much are we talking about
mm-hmm.
on the reference scenario, and is there really that much?
Depends on who you talk to in China. I'm not a coal supply analyst. I can't answer that question satisfactorily, I'm afraid. We don't actually have a program of cooperation with SEPA. We do run into people from SEPA from time to time, but in terms of things like closing down coal mine safety, the consolidation program you're talking about, the State Administration of Work Safety, you're talking about the coal bureaus within the major coal producing provinces, Shaanxi, Henan, and so forth. And these are agencies that are clearly feeling the heat. Their past tactics have been ineffective in improving quality of the coal supply, in improving safety, there does seem to be some new tactics are being taken. There's a lot of consolidation. I'm just talking about coal. I'll talk about efficiency later. There's consolidation going on in the coal industry, at least in the state-owned sector. A lot of the smaller state-owned mines are being required to either close or find larger companies that will buy them out by 2010. If you go to Shanxi, mines under a certain size will be forced to close by 2010 unless they find larger partners. And this seems to be actually happening. We've taken a couple of trips out there, of course, so we don't get to see everything we want to see. It seems to be something that, by all accounts, is happening. So consolidation is one route by which a lot of the targets for better environmental performance, greater energy efficiency, better safety, is going to happen. By their very nature, the smaller, less well-funded, less technically capable enterprises are always going to be more poorly performing. Now, of course, there are side effects to this sort of approach, unemployment and so forth, and that is an area that China doesn't seem to be dealing very well with at all. When we bring up issues of unemployment that are caused by closures of small facilities, the typical response is, well, most of the people employed there are migrant workers, and they will melt back into the landscape. Which doesn't seem to be a really satisfactory answer. So there do seem to be some trends that are will help to gradually improve environmental and energy performance, but possibly at the expense of creating other problems that need to be addressed or exacerbating them.
And actually, let me add on to that, because you have seen that increased interest in the local pollution. Maybe you can also comment on how climate change issues are now being viewed and what the balance in terms of policy drivers that takes versus the local, and has that relationship changed over time?
I wish I could answer your question about trading programs and implementation of SO2 standards, but it's not an area that I've had the opportunity to look at closely recently. So I'm afraid I have to defer on that one. In talking with people who are knowledgeable, there does seem to be inside and outside China, there does seem to be a sense that there's been a fundamental shift that implementation really is serious this time, and it actually is quite a bit easier when you have just a few larger players that you have to regulate. A few, you know, you have five large generators that are responsible for the majority of new build. And it's much easier to work with them. In addition, when you look at U.S. The trading system and emissions controls, one of the you have certain infrastructure that needs to be put in place before you can actually have an operable program. You need real-time emissions monitoring. Without that, you don't have a trading system, and that's something that's being discussed very seriously in China. With regard to climate is much discussed, but it is not a driver of any great consequence yet.
Jeff, thanks for the presentation. That was one of the most informative talks I've heard from an international group. Who now has a face to
Okay. in the 1980s, 1990s, becoming more efficient was relatively easy. You closed down some very old, inefficient factories, put in a few new ones, and become much more efficient. So technical efficiency was fairly easy to come by, particularly when a fairly significant proportion of capacity was new capacity. So you quickly sort of swamp the older, less efficient. A countervailing trend then was the growth of small enterprises, township and village enterprises, and a lot of industry in rural areas. But that was something of a, I won't say it's a passing phase, but that sector quickly became differentiated into really tiny and to fairly large, some world-class operations that were better in many cases in terms of energy and environmental performance than state-owned enterprises. There was an additional factor in that statistics from that era were much more subject to political interference than they are now. The GDP statistics were much worse than they are. Moving from the planning to a planning-based system to a more market-based system meant changes in prices, so the deflators for that period are a little bit dodgy. New classes of products were coming in, so new product classes would come on and appear to be much more contribute a great deal more to value added, but really weren't that much different from old ones. Anyway, this decade, a lot of the fat was already gone, and when the economy started to grow very quickly, very much based on investment, very high levels of investment in new industrial capacity and in infrastructure, which requires a lot of very energy-intensive materials. This pace, anybody who's been to China knows that the pace of building is just incredible. It requires a lot of metal, it requires a lot of cement, a lot of brick, all very energy-intensive things. And that really pulled energy intensity back down. When you look at the figures, energy intensity in China rose in only 2 years, 2003 and 2004, compared to previous years. In all the other years, it's declined. So the impression that the trend has reversed is maybe a little bit overstated. But what has happened is that improvement in intensity, that the fall in intensity has certainly slowed down quite a bit. The Chinese are now saying that in the first 9 months of this year, energy intensity fell by 3%. It's still not reaching their target. They need to bring it down by over 4% per year to reach their 20% target. They're off track, and they're likely to stay that way. But this energy-intensive development is also fed by their exports as well. When you look at, I don't know if Dr. Birol mentioned in his presentations, for this World Energy Outlook, a calculation was done of 2004 embedded energy in China's exports and imports. And about the equivalent of 28% of China's energy went to feed exports. But their imports, the energy embedded in imports, was equivalent to about 12%, so net 16% of China's energy is for exports. These are very difficult calculations to do. These are very approximate. You have to treat them with care. But overall, it's a much higher proportion than any other country. So a certain amount of China's growing energy intensity was due to their tremendous growth in feeding world markets for their products, Walmart and other countries. There is there has long been a large community within China that's been militating for an energy ministry. The energy bureau that was put together in NDRC has not been as effective as many wanted it to be. First of all, it's too low level to really get anything done, particularly with respect to the large power generators, CNPC is a ministry level operation. If you're not dealing with it at ministry level, then there's not much you can get done. Nobody in China that we've talked to over the past year or so about this issue is willing to confirm what's going to happen. The latest rumors are simply that it's very likely for this to happen, but essentially it's tied up with elite politics, who goes where, and it's really not going to be known until the announcement is made, because people really clam up about these issues, and in fact they don't know. Case in point, Chen Deming. We knew Chen Deming was going to move somewhere, and over a period of a couple of months, we received half a dozen different views on where he was going to go. He was going to replace Ma Kai. He was going to head the energy ministry. He was going to go here. He was going to go there. But none of them actually pointed towards the Ministry of Commerce. So China has the potential to surprise always. A couple of names have started to be floated for people who might head an energy ministry. Somebody might come from, well, don't. No. I've forgotten. No. That's. Unless, I don't know, was there something in the paper this morning about that? Okay.
On this actually, what's the thing and what the final structure would be? Mm-hmm. I assume that the Energy Ministry, the Energy Bureau, rather, and NDRC, and the National Energy Group would disappear if an Energy Ministry would be created?
Well, when asked about this, working level people say that what they've heard is that most would go over to the energy ministry, but a few would remain behind, not to rearrange the desks or something. I don't know, but they certainly weren't clear. These are people who would not be privy to the actual decision making, but just be hearing rumors themselves. Probably the things like CERC, the State Electricity Regulatory Commission, would remain on its own, a separate regulator. There does seem to be an acceptance that an independent regulator for the power sector is needed. But most of the scenarios that people are talking about include most of the people from the Energy Bureau going to the Energy Ministry, the Office of the National Energy Leading Group being folded into that, and additional staff being put in. The thing that most people seem to be excited about is that a new energy ministry would mean more people to do the job, and that that is indeed very exciting, and I'm jumping up and down inside about it. So,
presumably you would take the efficiency people as well out of the NDRC, the agency office, which there's been a split between the Energy Bureau and then the Energy Conservation Office.
That's true, but you may be being a bit presumptuous. So, when we've asked about this, everyone has said that it seems likely to remain at NDRC, which would be a step backwards. So, it's not a new energy ministry is not necessarily an unalloyed good. Yes.
Last year, I heard from a couple of folks in China, or stationed in China, that they're trying to get that sort of sentence into one of the
yeah. Yes, many have been trying to put that in. The draft version that I've seen just says, energy-related ministries under or energy-related organization under the agency, under the State Council. It can be read, it can be interpreted any way you want. If you use Babelfish or Google to translate it, you get all sorts of interesting translations, and that's what people have done. The Energy Foundation, the U.S. Energy Foundation, which has a China Sustainable Energy Program in Beijing, is in the process of translating the draft into English, and that should be available fairly soon. But the draft, I glanced through the draft, and it does not say energy ministry. So one of the comments, if you're privileged to comment on it to the Chinese government, you might ask, does this mean energy ministry? Can you please change this word? There certainly is increased in investment targeted in the five-year plan. I have to admit it's not an issue that I followed closely in the past year or so. When I last looked, the plans for investment in transport infrastructure lagged far behind what was necessary for moving it around. Things may have changed since then. But right now, the incremental ton of coal is going on the road, and those roads are coming to pieces very quickly. If you've been to Shanxi recently, those roads are dangerous. When you're driving down the road, what you see in front of you is a sea of weaving coal trucks, all heavily laden, going into and out of pits. The reason I usually don't see anything is because I have my eyes shut. So. But, yeah. Well, certainly a negotiating ploy. It seems to. They seem to be doing well with the Turkmens, but the Kazakhs are getting a little bit of a rash, it seems. The Chinese are counting on 30 billion cubic meters of gas from Central Asia. They don't expect at all. The deal with Turkmenistan is for all 30 billion cubic meters, but they don't expect it all to come from Turkmenistan. They expect it to come from there. And Kazakhstan mainly. So, but they are expecting it to the extent that they are in the process of building a second west-east pipeline. The resources are not there in Xinjiang to fill that pipeline. They're clearly expecting the Central Asian gas and counting on that gas to come in. The expectations of Russian gas in China are... well, they trust the Russians about as much as anybody else, and perhaps less. In some of the high-level meetings, it was very interesting to see how curious they were about IEA's views on Russia and the experience that the IEA member countries had in dealing with Russia. I'd like to take a little bit of... a lesson or two from experience. There's a lot of interest I think in the possibility for China to become a tremendous power in Central Asia. But what the IEA has been seeing. I don't go to Central Asia, but many people do. Bill Ramsey, Deputy Executive Director, goes there. The desk officer for Central Asia spent a lot of time there. And they're interested in playing the players off each other as much as possible. And Russia is very keen to continue its dominance in the region. So and China is a powerful card for them to play in getting out from under Russia's thumb. So a lot of it is negotiating ploys on the part of the Central Asian republics as well. But nevertheless, the Chinese seem to feel that out of all this morass, they will be able to pull some gas. It is not going to be nearly enough to push their energy system much more towards gas, as you've already seen. They're going to continue to rely on LNG imports. The Russians are unreliable. I believe the Chinese, Sakhalin 3 has kind of fallen through for the Chinese as well. It seems like China's getting better or more willing to play ball in the new LNG markets, but there's not a lot. There's not a huge amount for them to draw on there. So the future for gas in China is fairly dim, which is why you see them trumpeting things like the Puguang field, which is significant but relatively small in terms of the overall needs. That's a good question. It often depends on the individuals. My job is to coordinate across the divisions. There are more than a dozen divisions, and virtually all of them have something to do with outreach with China. I'm the sort of person who just crashes through people's doors and says, "How are you doing?" And I, often find out interesting things that way. In the economic analysis division, which prepares the World Energy Outlook each year, they're very, very focused on their activity. They will reach out and ask questions and bring in information. Unless they need something specific from you, you're not likely to hear from them. So it always pays to go in and talk with them. I find myself facilitating exchanges between them and, say, the folks in the energy technology office who are doing the bottom-up modeling, sort of energy technology perspectives, if you're familiar with that. That's a sort of bottom-up outlook to 2050 to see what technologies can provide globally in order to bring down CO2 emissions. So the energy analysis, economic analysis division has recently been promoted to an office level division, and Dr. Birol's been given responsibility for ensuring coordination across the agency between the various models that are being used. So it's an issue that that Mr. Tanaka has tried to address with a bit of reorganization. Hopefully that will play out positively.
Just one question. This is a kind of a follow-up on the environmental piece. If you look at mm-hmm. increased use of coal, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. what extent have you actually seen activity on capture and sequestration?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion here about we have a lot of candidate sites
mm-hmm.
that are pretty close in terms of reinjection sites, but that no one's mapped.
Mm-hmm.
China.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't even know how to go about doing it. So,
The subject of mapping potential sites has certainly come up, particularly in the near zero emissions coal-fired power plant project that the European Commission and the UK are working on. The European Commission has set up a long-term cooperation, wasn't going very far. UK stepped in with some real money to get it started, and part of that is supposed to be a broad assessment of sites. But that's running into a bit of opposition. There are supposedly some security concerns. I think the bigger concerns on the part of the Chinese are that such an assessment would reveal a very large number of extremely promising sites, and that would give everybody else ammunition to say, "Hey, you got all these saline aquifers. Please, go ahead. So, a bit of a sticking point there.
Well, I think, Jonathan, you've done a great job, and I want to say how much we appreciate you stopping by. And I think that we probably used up your energies now in the presentation. So,
yes.
Thank you very much, and join me in.
Thank you for inviting me. Okay.